Hello and welcome to this Monday night recording of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I am your host, Nipun Chopra. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. In a memorable day, Leicester City were officially declared champions of the Premier League after a feisty draw between Chelsea and Spurs. We'll talk about the Premier League title race, which is now, I guess, over, in Section 1, relegation battle in Section 2, and the rest of the Premier League, as well as preview the Champions League games in Section 3. In order to help me do that, I'm joined by Karthik Krishnayar, and making his reappearance on World Soccer Talk, Chris Henoch. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me tonight.
Good to be with you.
I have to say at this point that we actually had another recording with Chris. It was lost to the world of software mismanagement. This was about a month ago before I left for India. So I'm glad Chris is back officially on World Soccer Talk. And along with Karthik, this will be a partnership that will continue for a while now. So guys, let's get into block one, where we'll talk about the title challengers and the top four. The title challenge is now over after the first game, which we'll discuss today, which was Chelsea and Spurs, the Monday night game. Lots of vitriol and comments made in the media before this game, and that kind of translated into the game itself. And Karthik, I'll start with you. A very open game and lots of flying tackles. Clattenburg probably should have shown a yellow and might have settled the game. So your thoughts on this game?
Well, we've had so much controversy about officiating between some of the John Moss and some of the incidents in England, and then here in the States, constant controversy in MLS and in NASL. That I have to say, honestly, I think Clattenburg did about the best job he could in this chippy affair. Maybe he could have shown a yellow earlier, but he did finally try and take control of the match and couldn't really gain control of it. But it was just that kind of affair. Let's just lay it out there: Spurs and Chelsea, bitter rivals. The supporters, bitter rivals. This is an opportunity for Spurs to win for the first time at Stamford Bridge in 26 years and win a title, an English title, for the first time in over 50. And you've got a situation where Chelsea, the defending champions, they've had a terrible season. They've sacked their manager. They've had all kinds of trouble. But one thing that would satisfy them is to see Spurs not win the title, defeat their hated rivals, and hand the title to someone else who happens to be coached by a former Chelsea manager. So much on the line. You could just feel the tension from the get-go. And it was something you couldn't take your eyes off of. I mean, I guess you could take your eyes off the match, but it was also so tense that it didn't have the quality. And I know we're going to get to this in a minute, Nipun, of the match between Manchester United and Leicester, which I really felt was a quality match between two teams trying to win. This seems a chippy affair between two teams that were desperate for the result, given the circumstances I laid out, but just something more, and maybe because it's the rivalry between the two clubs, something else boiled over and it became, at one end, something you couldn't miss. You couldn't take your eyes off, but at the other end, something you didn't really want to watch.
While the vitriol and the tackles existed throughout the game, I thought the level of play was from each team was different in each half, Chris. I thought it was a game of two halves in that sense. Spurs were much the better team in the first half. Chelsea started kind of strong. They had that chance from Fabregas in the first 5 minutes. But beyond that, didn't create much of note in the first half. And Spurs, via some brilliance from Lamella, Harry Kane, and of course Eriksen, went in with a two-goal lead. In the second half, however, totally different game. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I think you touched on Lamella there again. That was another impressive first half showing from him. Nice to see his kind of improvement continue. What concerns me from a Chelsea perspective is that it took this game for them to show some real passion and fight this season. I haven't seen that kind of commitment to the cause from that group at all this season prior to this evening. And certainly it boiled over in some nasty ways, and it wasn't the prettiest game in the world. And I'm sure there were a lot of instances that reaffirmed the negative stereotype of professional football at the top level. What I would say, though, is they were able to rally, they were able to show something in a match that relative to them outside of the rivalry that you can define in your own ways, means very little. They've now lost the Premier League title and handed it to Leicester by stopping Spurs. And the whole sort of vibe around the thing was very weird. It didn't feel like a club that were losing the Premier League title in that regard. It's almost like they've accepted that fate and almost reveled in the gallows humour of giving it to Leicester. So it was a very bizarre one in that sense. And I think what I would say is I would echo the sentiments of James Horncastle, who kind of joked that Antonio Conte could still turn the job down if he wanted. I think he's got a huge amount of work to undertake next season, not just in terms of reshaping the squad, working out which youngsters to bring in, because I think he will have to bring some in, but also just in terms of giving them an identity and a bit of spirit back, because it seems as if there's a good number of the bigger players there who I would argue are quite willing to walk at this point and look like they're already set on doing so in the summer.
Karthi, Chris makes some great points there regarding the job that Conte has in the summer and going beyond. But let's talk about Pochettino. First of all, it's not really... at this point, we know that he is staying at Spurs. But have Spurs missed what might be their best chance ever to win the Premier League? Or are they title favourites, as you predicted early on, for next season?
I think they're title favourites for early on for next season. And I keep hearing this speculation about Pochettino, Real Madrid, Manchester United. You know, there's an inherent curse in managing a big club. Rafa Benitez
right.
has learned it again now. 6 months at Real Madrid, and luckily for him, the Newcastle job was open. But you sometimes don't want that. And I think Pochettino is in a situation where he has already accomplished more than any Spurs manager since Terry Venables, maybe since before that. So maybe since Nicholson. I mean, since the legend. So you're looking at a guy that I think is very comfortable. He's got a young team. They have probably the most competitive young core of any club in Europe right now, which is why if you go to Manchester United, you've got rebuilding to do. You've got rebuilding to do in at Real Madrid. The Spurs youth teams, very importantly, are beginning to play the Pochettino way. So I don't think he's going anywhere, and I don't think this is something that Spurs need to be let down about. Now, I have to say one thing, though, about this. They didn't win the title, but now they need to finish ahead of Arsenal. That's very right. important psychologically for them when they look back on the season. The gap is now only 3 points. So Spurs, they have I forget who they face this week, but they go to Newcastle in the final match where Rafa Benitez's side is going to be fighting for survival. I think they better hope Arsenal drop points to Manchester City. Otherwise, it could be another night like the food poisoning night in 2006 or 2013 when Arsenal beat Newcastle on the last day and celebrated as Arsenal as they finished a point ahead of Spurs. They don't want to finish behind Arsenal now. I think that's the key.
The fire that we saw from Chelsea was, as Chris mentioned, was something that we haven't seen all season, and it was impressive, and it also coincided with some very good performances. Eden Hazard coming on for the second half was excellent, not only for what is probably the goal of this of the weekend, but also his overall play, his movement, his ability to get inside and outside of the right back Walker. So I guess the question with Eden Hazard is, do you guys see him staying at Chelsea beyond the summer, or is he playing for a move to PSG at this point, Chris?
I don't see him staying personally. I think enough of his body language, his season, all of that kind of melded into one situation suggests that it's time for him to go as much as anything. And that's that can often be the most difficult thing when you invested £32 million in a player and you have someone that you know is worth a lot more than that now is knowing when to let go of that. And I think equally, I'm not sure where he fits into a Conte side personally. I think if you're putting him out wide, and it's just my opinion that Conte's always preferred someone that has a little bit more industry to them, maybe in wide positions. I don't know if Hazard has that. Whereas if he goes back to France, which for me personally seems a bizarre move anyway, because he's already won the French title with Lille, then at least he can have, again, a little bit more of that freedom and that cavalier approach with PSG because of the way they're set up. And equally, you look at PSG and say, well, they're phasing out Zlatan, or well, he's leaving rather than being phased out, I should say. So they're looking for that next superstar themselves. And who better than someone like Eden Hazard, who already has that reputation in France, is very highly thought of, and has a few years to run on him. So in theory, could be there for the long term. Whether he's the person to elevate them in the Champions League, I'm not entirely sold on that one, to be honest, because I think he was sort of seen as someone that could do that for Chelsea and didn't. So putting him in arguably a more intense situation where there's even more expectation on him doesn't seem like the best way to handle things. But in terms of his future at Chelsea, I just struggle to see one there for him. I think there's been too many bridges burnt with this season.
Well, I think this is important for Belgium this summer. I know we're winding down the Premier League season, running down the European season. We only have one active title race, which is Dortmund and Bayern. That'll probably be over this weekend. One active. Spain. We have a very active title race. So that's my fault. But I think looking at the Euros, this is important for Hazard because Belgium comes in as the great curiosity for so many of us. Historically, they've never won anything. They've got this mishmash of players, all of which are very, very talented. We've even seen guys that we didn't fancy, like Origi, the last few weeks really come good for Liverpool before he got injured, the impact of Jurgen Klopp's management. And to me, the missing piece for Belgium is Hazard. If you have a Hazard who's feeling in the mood, along with whether it's Origi or Lukaku, one of those two guys up top, De Bruyne, and then Alderweireld, who for me has been the best defender in the Premier League this season, him anchoring that back line from
along
Spurs,
with
speaking of this match. Along with Vertonghen, right, and company if he's fit. You just have and Dembele, who's had his best season in the Premier League this season with Spurs. You just have the makings of a team, irrespective of the lack of history and the lack of pedigree, that could win the Euros, and maybe should win the Euros. So I am curious to see how Hazard finishes out the season, these last two games with Chelsea, and we'll worry about the transfers till after the Euros. I'm curious to see how he plays into the Euros.
So let's transition from here into the United versus Leicester game from yesterday. The first thing I want to talk about, Karthik, I'll come to you. I was so midweek after a good showing in the FA Cup, Van Gaal continued with his experiment with Rooney in midfield, switching to a 4-3-3, making it the 748th. Formation he's played this season. And it was interesting to see why he did that. In the first half, I thought it kind of worked. I thought having three in midfield counterbalanced Conte and Drinkwater, who have been the standout, has been the standout midfield in the Premier League, really, at Leicester. The two goals, Martial's goal was equalized by Wes Morgan. And I thought, in general, United were the better team, but Leicester threatened a bunch from set pieces.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think Leicester were relying on set pieces, and we've seen them do this at times this season. In fact, I guess you could look at the game that ultimately probably decided the title was Robert Huth's goal on a late set piece at White Hart Lane. Just
right.
At a time, that was really the one definitive wobble we saw from Leicester this season, and they had drawn with Bournemouth, they had drawn with Aston Villa, remember, and they went to White Hart Lane, and we were thinking they were falling out of the top four. Lo and behold, they come away with that goal, and they end up winning the title. They go back on a run, they climb from third to first, and they've seen it out. Set pieces have been important for them all season long, and the thing I really liked about this match, the thing I enjoyed was, I thought the tactical wrinkle was good for Manchester United. It was you were able to get Martial into the kind of one-on-one matchups that you don't see Leicester lose very often. But Danny Simpson had a hard time with him in this match. And Richard Farley and I, our colleague, and I have talked all season long about these one-on-one matchups and how generally, tactically, Ranieri is the guy who finds a way to isolate his players in advantageous one-on-one matchups. And that didn't happen in this game there. And then I felt like in the first half, Michael Carrick was pretty effective in negating the effective midfield play of Drinkwater and Conte, who I agree with you have been the best combo in the league this season. Though I must say, as the game wore on, I felt like Conte's influence really grew. Mm-hmm. And again, for me, he's the player of the year. I know Mahrez and Vardy have split the two awards, but you could give it to any number of Leicester players. But for me, Conte is the best player in this league. I mean, to me, he's one of the best players in the world right now.
Chris, talk to me about Leicester City. This is a game that United needed the points more than Leicester City did. Leicester were without Jamie Vardy, their record, I guess, goal scorer at this point now. I thought, in general, Leicester City did just enough, but were you a little underwhelmed at what might have been, what could have been a convincing win for Leicester? I know in retrospect, now that they've won the league, it doesn't mean much, but your thoughts on Leicester's performance?
I thought they were solid for large periods. Again, they were tested more than I think they have been for most of the season. I think in some ways that, that's really benefited them, is that a lot of people haven't expected a great deal. And I think there's been a consistent level of arrogance in their opponents, in the sense that they thought they wouldn't fall into the same traps that those before them had, and thought that they could outplay them in ways that just aren't really doable given Leicester's style of play. I think they did get a little bit fortunate with the penalty or free kick decision that
Right.
wasn't given towards the end, when which Drinkwater was sent off. And I think if you're looking through the season and you talk about league title wins and those kind of situations, it is one of those intangibles that's always stacked up alongside that actually the team in question had the decisions when they needed to have the decisions. It's things like the Okazaki goal being given onside when Jamie Vardy's offside. It's things like the Dani Drinkwater second yellow card. These things that rack up and just help you continue that momentum. It's funny, I know Alan Pardew got a lot of pelters for saying that Palace could have been in an identical situation had they had more decisions. I think his point is slightly laboured and a bit obtuse, but I see the argument he's forging, that actually there is just that slither of fortune that's helped Leicester towards this as well. But it
I
is
think.
founded on a bedrock of stability and really compact defensive play, which is a real joy to watch given how unstructured the Premier League's become in the last few years.
Yeah, I think that penalty decision kind of counterbalanced the penalty earlier, which Rojo should have conceded on Mahrez, which, when you saw the replay, he really did foul Mahrez. I think it was difficult to see in real time, however. Go ahead, Tom.
The thing I want to point out about that is that I think Mahrez and Vardy, and they've split the Player of the Year honors, the two major awards, and they're two of the best players in this league. But I think they both earned a reputation for diving from referees this season, to where they're not getting those calls. To me, that was a clear penalty. But if it had been, let's say, Conte or Albrighton or Drinkwater, maybe it would have been called. I think Mahrez has gained a reputation for diving, and Vardy has gotten a well-deserved reputation for embellishment and diving, and that's why he's not playing, of course. Didn't play in these last two games.
Yeah, I think had United had the same fire that Chelsea did in what was a must-win game for United, they might have actually been able to win this game. But disappointingly, they end with a draw. They are now 4 points behind Man City with a game in hand, and it doesn't seem likely that they will make it to the top four. West Ham is just a point behind them, and we'll actually transition to the West Ham 3-0 win over West Brom in this game. West Brom, first of all, Chris, very unimpressive, except for maybe Jonathan Lico. Pretty typical West Ham performance. Had the four central defenders in all the four positions as fullbacks, also including Johnny Evans at left back. The banks of three in the midfield, the same thing we've seen. It took the substitution of Berahino on into the second half that actually led to some chances for West Brom. But in general, very unimpressive. West Ham, on the other hand, some brilliant play by Payet yet again.
Yeah, I think Lecco was the silver lining of West Brom's cloud. And again, I think this is why Tony Pulis and West Brom fans have that little bit of friction between them, is that he's a very dour manager. And we can talk about him wanting to sign attacking players in inverted commas and add something to the team. I don't think it would change them dramatically, because I don't think naturally he is an expansive manager. I think you can be defensively rigid, but also still play beautiful football. Look at what Claudio Ranieri's done, the man that we started the show with. He's done that. I don't think the two have to be separate in that sense. And again, the way that they finish the season, there is this weird habit I'm noticing with Tony Pulis, that once his team's hit 40 points, it's very much turn the engine off and cruise to the end of the season. And there comes a point where fans won't take that, where they will look at the investment of tickets and all of those other things as wasted money, and why should we bother? And I think this is why it so often does fall sour for him, whether it be at Stoke or whether it be at Palace, is that he's given money to spend and he doesn't spend it well, and then asks for more money and says that he can fix things. But like anyone who gets into that vicious cycle, they always think they can fix it with just a little bit more money. I think you contrast that with West Ham again, who've gone out and they have wasted money on the likes of Matt Jarvis, but I would sort of counter that with the fact that they went out and bought someone like Ener Valencia and someone like Dimitri Payet, who have actually elevated them to the next level. And I think they deserve immense credit for not just finding those players, but actually investing large sums of money in them, because it's easier said than done. And I think, again, if everyone had gone after Payet with the same ferocity that West Ham had, maybe he'd be somewhere else. Maybe he'd be doing something else. And that in itself, I think, deserves credit. It's just very contrasting in that sense. You've got one team that is playing very attacking football and playing a very exciting style alongside this West Brom side, who again are just coasting. And I think if I was having to buy a season ticket at one club next season, I wouldn't be booking many train tickets to the Midlands.
Karthik, you were talking about the Euros. Talk to me about how Mark Noble should be starting for England.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if he should be starting, but he should be in the team. Cresswell's another guy I like on West Ham a lot that isn't getting a look from England, which is odd because West Ham used to be the great English club. They used to be the club that could automatically put people into the England conversation. This team, Noble, has really improved this season under Slaven Bilic as a two-way player. I think Kevin Nolan not being there has helped him, has given him a little more range, a little more mobility in how he plays. And to me, West Ham, again, the table, we say the table doesn't lie at the end of the season. To me, it might somewhat in this specific case where I think clearly Leicester and Spurs are the top two teams in the league. To me, West Ham has been the third best team consistently through the season. They've just had a couple of these late draws, the Chelsea game where there was that penalty, that unfortunate penalty that was called, the Crystal Palace game where Coyote was wrongly sent off. A couple of strange decisions that have gone against them that have stopped them from being in the top four, but they continue to really impress me. And Noble has just become such a good two-way player and a guy that, Roy Hodgson has been willing to take chances on some of the young players from Spurs, and rightly so, the Eric Dyers and the Dele Allis, Harry Kanes, and others. But he hasn't given the likes of Cresswell and Mark Noble a look, and that really surprises me.
The win for West Ham leaves them 5 points behind Manchester City and a point behind Man United. Both United and West Ham have a game in hand. Let's move ahead to the Arsenal 1-0 win over Norwich. Chris, I thought Arsenal were entirely dominant for most of this game. There was the usual intricate passing that we've come to associate with Arsenal. There was some background to this game with some supporters who wanted to show their dissent towards towards Wenger in his 750th game as Arsenal manager. It took the substitution of Welbeck to produce the game-winning goal. But in general, this game, again, which actually had repercussions at both the top as well as the bottom, went down to nothing of... There was nothing of note in this game. Your thoughts on this game?
I thought Norwich let themselves down with poor finishing, which...
Yeah.
Having watched talk Norwich City sporadically this season, that seems to have been an issue for them most of the campaign. And again, they remind me a little bit of Burnley in that regard. I feel like they're a team that is a very good championship team, but maybe doesn't have the quality enough to keep itself safe in the Premier League or keep itself away from that danger at least. And that's the concern, is that, again, you think, could you spend the money differently had you got Mbakani at the start of the season? Does that change things? Because he is a forward with a lot of pedigree and has played in the Champions League. The curious contrast with Arsenal is that, again, they seem to have the quality. My issue with them, and I was talking to my old man about this, is that when you look at the Invincibles and the teams that really did succeed, yes, they passed the ball beautifully, but they weren't as ponderous as the current Arsenal team are. They were actually quite direct with it. And the beauty was not necessarily in how many passes it took, but how seamlessly they were stitched together to cut through a team. So you look at kind of the Vieira goal at Anfield is a really good example, I think, of that in the blue away kit. That, to me, typifies that generation of Arsenal. This one, it feels a little bit like a bad basketball game where it's just getting passed around the perimeter. It's turn, go wide. If there's not an angle, come back. Go down the other side. That is very rarely going to break a team down because you can just sit behind the ball and be organised and spring on it. And in many regards, I see why the Arsenal fans want change, because not only have they seen their North London rivals surpass them at this point in the Premier League, they've also seen Leicester mount a title challenge and successfully mount a title challenge, I should add. And that's going to concern you when, for so long, your argument has been, oh, we don't spend enough money. We haven't spent enough money. We need to spend more money. Leicester have really shattered that theory,
right?
If you think about it. And that's the concern, is that I think when they say time for change, I don't even think they're necessarily just talking about Arsene Wenger. I think they're talking about Olivier Giroud. I think they're talking about Walcott, Chamberlain, maybe to a lesser degree, Ramsey, the players that have been trusted to carry the club forward that haven't delivered. So the change is not solely rooted in the dugout. It's rooted almost in what the club's sort of ethos has become, which is fourth place is acceptable.
Karthik, I think Arsenal, as Chris is hinting here, Arsenal did just enough to do what was necessary. They got the 3 points. They're 3 points ahead of City and a win away from Spurs, who are 3 points ahead of them. So they did what they had to. But from a Norwich City perspective, interesting that they didn't play Mbeki or Naismith, players who a player who has had some success against Arsenal before while he was at Everton. Did they miss a chance here with Arsenal being out of form?
Yeah, they certainly did. Although, I mean, I think Alex Neil's thought was to keep it tight, and we've seen Arsenal have plenty of nil-nil draws in these sorts of circumstances, right? Through the years and even in recent weeks. So I think his thinking was keep it tight and then bring those guys on if we need to late on. Ultimately, that was the wrong thinking. Arsenal far superior, as Chris mentioned. It seemed like they were always going to get a goal in this game, and it took Welbeck coming on to deliver that, but yes, a missed opportunity. And looking at Norwich's fixture list coming in, and the fixture list of Sunderland and Newcastle, I know we'll get to them in the next segment. You can't. You've just got to go for it at this point.
Yeah, I agree. So let's talk about the final game in this section, which was Southampton 4-2 win against City. Karthik, a very heavily rotated City side, was taken to the sword by particularly Sadio Mane, and for me, Dusan Tadic was incredible in this game, a throwback to his performances last season. And talk to me about Sterling. His finishing let him down again. Iheanacho probably has to start midweek, right, alongside Aguero. He's probably your most informed player right now.
Yeah, or you start Iheanacho in the silver role in the hole behind Aguero. I think what you probably do in a 4-2-3-1 and play De Bruyne on the left, cutting inside, and then Navas on the right. Yeah, Manchester City have been very poor throughout much of this Premier League season. This seemed like a very, unfortunately, a very predictable outcome, a predictable scoreline. Guys that are just not at the races. It's becoming a recurring theme that if City are not up for the occasion, they can't grind out results. They get opened up early, they give up goals early, lose their composure, and just seem on the whole disinterested. And that was this game. Yet another sad indictment of what's happened at the club. And there's this general sense among supporters that Pep Guardiola is going to come in, wave a magic wand, and you're going to be very good next season. Well, I'm not sure about that. Chelsea should improve. Liverpool will improve for certain. I don't think Spurs are going to get any worse. Arsenal probably be around the same. Manchester United probably be around the same or better. So I think this was a lens into what a tough rebuild Pep Guardiola has for outsiders, because even though Manchester City has spent a ton of money, we've said it all season long on this show, they don't have very much depth considering the amount of money that's been spent. And when you begin to rotate players, you get performances like this. And that should not happen to any top club.
Chris, let me ask you this question. I think every season from now until the end of time, we will be asking, who is the next Leicester City? And let me pose this to you. It's possible that Southampton is next season Leicester City. They have a very, very good manager. They have some excellent players in the likes of Mane, Wanyama, even Shane Long, who is very underrated. They have a good goalkeeper in Forster, Tadic, who's been excellent again, Ward-Prowse. The list goes on and on. And of course, some decent defensive effort also towards the second half of the season. Is it possible Southampton is next season's Leicester City, or are they going to hemorrhage players like they did a summer and a half ago?
I don't know if they'll hemorrhage players. What I would say is I'm not convinced of the credentials of them being the next Leicester City. And I say that because I don't know if they have enough goals in them, in the sense that you've got Pele, Sadio Mane, Shane Long, all on sort of 10 there at this precise moment, and Tadic on 7. It's the consistency is the issue. That's my concern. You really need someone to be pushing closer to 20, as Jamie Vardy is doing. And then you need someone like Mahrez in behind it. It's also the defence that slightly unsettles me with Southampton. In fact, to be truthful, it unsettles me more than their ability to score goals. One of the reasons I think they've got those three forwards on 10 goals is because they hemorrhage a lot. So against City, they conceded 2. Against Villa, it was 2. Everton 1. Newcastle 1. Liverpool 2. You know, they couldn't find the net against Leicester at all. So it's those fine margins that I think really define it. If you look at Leicester, a lot of their performances, it was 1-0. In fact, I think they had a string of them around the time that they beat Southampton to really just cement themselves at the top. I don't know if I can see Southampton performing in that same way and essentially producing enough of the really tight, clean sheets that are needed for this to happen.
Karthik, your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I tend to agree with that. I think Southampton, they had some shocking performances this season. They were very tight at the back last year, but some shocking performances defensively this season. And there seems to be just a lack of consistency in the side. We've seen this season at times them dip into what appear to be relegation for a month and a half. I think in two different occasions. So I'm not sure they have the consistency yet to do this. I the side I'm intrigued by is West Ham, and we can talk about this on another show, but they are moving into the Olympic Stadium next season. If they can keep this core together, maybe they're the team that pushes. They're a London club also, so you see that advantage in attracting guys like Payet to the club. Maybe they're the team that's the outsider that makes the run next season.
Okay. Well, when we come back in Section 2, we'll talk about the relegation battle, the games that, teams at the bottom of the league, and then we'll come back to talk about the other games of the Premier League this weekend and preview the Champions League in Section 3. We'll be right back. This is World Soccer Talk Podcast. While Aston Villa has been relegated, the battle between Newcastle, Sunderland, Norwich City still remains, still continues. And as we mentioned, Arsenal beating Norwich City 1-0. The other, so let's really quickly talk about the Watford Villa game, get that out of the way. A win for Watford, 3-2 against Villa. It was a game of little consequence, Karthik. Watford with the come from behind win. I actually felt a little bad for Villa. I thought Sissoko was sent off a bit unfairly, and that changed the game. It went from 2-1 in the 89th minute, to 3-2 with a couple of goals from Troy Deeney. Maybe the only thing worth mentioning, I guess, Chris, is Jordan Ayew is the standout star for Villa right now. Probably a player that will be highly contested for in the summer.
Yeah, shades of Andros Townsend at QPR and Scott Carson at Charlton many years ago in terms of a player that is shining in the midst of relegation. You could equally forge an argument, though, to say that he was one of the many players that let them down this season. I was watching a sort of season review on Ball Street with one of their fans, and he essentially said that actually the foreign players hadn't let Villa down at all. It was the crux of English and local players like Julian Lescott who'd really let the club down. And I think, you know, the problem I think Villa have at the minute is they keep finding new ways to embarrass themselves. And I say that in the sense that first off, Lescott comes out and says that it's a relief to be relegated. This gives them a freedom potentially. It means the pressure's off. They then go and take a 2-1 lead at Watford and then still manage to mess things up. So you could argue that this club is really quite rotten at the core at the minute and will require significant changes in the summer in terms of player personnel, on top of the fact they're going to have to now bring in a new manager as well to oversee everything. And that will require deep pockets, which, excuse me, is not without a reminder of the fact that the start of this slide for Villa comes after Martin O'Neill leaves and Randy Lerner decides to really kind of bring back the budgets for the sole reason that he felt they were overspending. They couldn't keep up with it. 10 million on Curtis Davis, this kind of acquisitions just weren't sustainable for them. So in reducing those budgets, he's actually potentially cost the club a lot more in the future, because now they're going to miss out on a significant payment next season. And then, you know, predicting the future is akin to throwing a coin at this precise moment. You've got no idea until it lands.
Karthik, from a Watford perspective, there was a moment earlier in the season where we were talking about Watford and West Ham with the same sort of analysis. After that came a bit of a slide for Watford. This result keeps them in 12th. And let's be honest, at the end of the day, the goal was to stay in the Premier League. Kiki Sanchez-Flores has done a good job. Good result for Watford.
Yeah, I suppose so. He's under a lot of pressure now, Kiki Sanchez-Flores. We know the Pozzo family's not shy about sacking managers, changing managers, changing philosophies. So this is an important win for him. I don't know if it's too little too late. On the surface, based on the expectations for the season, they have come through with flying colors. I think what Kiki Sanchez-Flores has gotten out of this club is remarkable. They've been a well-organized side. Kapu, until he got hurt, had been fantastic as a guy, kind of that linchpin in central midfield. And once Ighalo and Deeney's goals dried up, now Deeney got 2 goals at the end of this match after Sissoko got sent off, but once those goals dried up, they were losing a lot of 1-0 games or 2-1 matches. So I think you just go out and address it and get a Premier League level striker, Ighalo and Deeney, 2 guys they brought up from the Championship, and maybe you've solved some of your problems. But chances are they're still going to look in another direction for another manager, which is unfortunate because I think Kiki Sanchez-Flores has done a very good job with this side.
I think that's one thing Watford have to be careful of, though, is this really cold and blunt approach to managers, in the sense that they will chop them quite easily if it's not Sanchez-Flores, it's Slakisi Jukanovic last season. That in itself could very much narrow down the potential candidates to succeed him, in the sense that it doesn't feel as if there's that loyalty there, because again, nothing was guaranteed when Sanchez-Flores came in. He's taken them to a cup semi-final, safety in the Premier League, and okay, it hasn't been beautiful at all in all parts of the season, but I think there's been enough for them to be pleased with. So the fact that they're willing to dispense, on the one hand you could say, okay, that's ruthless business, and then it's admirable in that regard that they have so much ambition, but sometimes you have to think maybe a little bit of patience would be better served for Watford at this precise moment.
Let's move ahead to the game between Newcastle and Crystal Palace. Chris, I'll come back to you here. The game was decided by a great free kick by Townsend. For me, watching the game, Newcastle were much the better team, especially in the first half. They were playing without Shelvey, Iosi, or Mitrovic, and looked very organized, especially in the center of the park, playing that 4-2-3-1 that we know Benitez tends to love. So your thoughts on this win for Newcastle, which really was a must-win game for them, keeps them just outside the relegation zone right now. Sunderland and Norwich, having played 1 game less than Newcastle, are a point and 2 points respectively behind Newcastle.
I think you touched on it there yourself, the fact that even Andros Townsend said afterwards, he got the feeling that Palace came to relegate Newcastle, that they weren't really bothered about a point or anything else. They'd come to really stuff them down in the mire and the ditch a bit further. Then you look at the team selection for Newcastle, again, missing the likes of Shelvey and Perez. I think what you're seeing with Benitez is someone that knows what he wants from the team for the most part, which is organisation and a really compact 11. And that's why he keeps picking Jack Colback and Cheick Tiote. And credit to Colback, I've been very critical of him throughout this season. He has drastically improved since Benitez arrived. And if you look at just that midfield too, it's a lot tighter now. They're a lot closer together, and they provide much more of a shield to the back four, which in turn has improved through the inclusion of Jamal Lascelle, someone who, again, was criticised quite heavily when he did come in. Personally, I put it on Twitter that I felt he had a lot of potential, and I could see him being a very good centre-back. It's just that idea, again, of keeping things tight and not letting in a great number of goals. When they've struggled to do that, credit to them, they've held their head and not really capitulated entirely. The Southampton result aside, they've managed to stay focused. And in these tighter games, the likes of Palace and Swansea, and then the ones that will come up against Villa and Tottenham, that could be huge for them, because they're able to score a goal. There's enough attacking talent in there between the likes of Mitrovic and Wijnaldum and Sissoko, and more importantly Townsend, the man we touched on there, to get a goal or maybe get 2 goals. And when you have that ability matched with a very dogged defensive mentality, I think you're going to manage to climb out of that mire. And they've given themselves a lot more of a chance than they had after Southampton. I think many, self included, had them going down after that, and understandably so.
Karthik, the Newcastle's next two fixtures are Villa away and home to Spurs. Your thoughts on their ability to win, sorry, to stay in the Premier League. Probably will win the Villa game, but the Spurs game is very tricky.
Well, they can't let up in that Villa game. It's a bit of a trap game, especially with things going so well for Newcastle. And then the final match against Spurs is just going to be a great atmosphere at St. James Park. There's a belief now among Newcastle fans. Chris can speak to this better than any of us, obviously. But even the day they appointed Rafa Benitez, that malaise, that kind of anti-Mike Ashley thing that had just consumed club fandom, I don't want to say it went away because it didn't. There's still a very strong anti-Mike Ashley a kind of shameful streak among Newcastle fans. Not shameful in the way they behave, but shameful toward the club. They feel shame about the club. But there was a new sense of optimism with Rafa coming in. I think they had thought, a lot of them, that Rafa would get instant results. It took 4 or 5 matches for him to really get rolling, which speaks to the point about potentially making this move earlier. He was sacked by Real Madrid in January, in late January. But once they made it, now they're playing very well. They look like a team that's interested. They look like a team that's enthused, that's playing for results, which I think it's a little bit unfair on Steve McClaren, because most clubs that are fighting relegation are not going to be able to attract a manager of Rafa Benitez's pedigree mm-hmm. or caliber to their club. Let's just face it. Most managers you get at that level in the table, particularly with relegation at the time, looking fairly certain, are going to be at McLaren's level or maybe even less. Mm-hmm. Last time Newcastle was in this position 7 years ago, they ended up with Alan Shearer and Ian Dowie, for heaven's sake. So I think it's unfair, the McLaren-Benitez comparison. That having been said, I mean, Mike Ashley, for all of his faults, if Benitez keeps them up, what a move. And assuming Benitez stays in the Newcastle job, which I have to assume he will, if they stay up, he wants to manage in England. He stated that when he got sacked by Real Madrid. This isn't a temporary thing. I think he wants to stay in English football long term again. You have to think that they'll be they will not be threatened by relegation next season.
It's interesting when I look at the remaining fixtures, gentlemen. It looks like Everton and Watford will have a huge impact on this relegation battle. Both those teams play both Sunderland and Norwich City in the last remaining game. So both those teams might, results against both those teams might decide the relegation battle coming up. So let's transition to the third game in this section, which is Stoke's draw, 1-1 draw with Sunderland. Very few chances, Karthik, in the first half, except for a couple of crouch headers. I saw your tweet where you talked about how you see the irony in the fact that Stoke is trying to create this huge change in football under Hughes, but their goal and most of their chances came from knockdowns or headers involving Peter Crouch.
Yeah, and this is the desperation of Stoke now, because they've been so poor the last few weeks. So terrible. The last they had given up 4 goals in 3 successive matches coming into this one. That having been said, it worked. It was effective. I fully expected Big Sam. Now there was a toughness, a mental resiliency, and they got that point late with the penalty, and Big Sam pointed it to his heart. But I fully expected Sunderland to take 3 points in this match, I have to tell you, and was disappointed in their performance. And I've said for months now on this show, Sunderland would not get relegated because they were playing better than their results. Big Sam had them organized. They were eventually going to start winning games. It hasn't happened. They're still getting draws. Newcastle's winning games now. So I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see what happens in that match in hand. But now I'm beginning to tilt toward Newcastle getting out, which obviously I've been very consistent on this show that Sunderland would stay up and Newcastle would go down. But they're not getting 3 points in matches where they should either be better than their opposition or they are better than their opposition. The exception being the head-to-head with Norwich, which was a 6-pointer. So, yeah, I obviously route won a lot for Stoke in this match, but I was disappointed by Sunderland and their performance.
The one thing, Chris, that Sunderland fans will be happy about is that their team kept going right till the end and definitely will feel that they created enough chances to warrant Jermaine Defoe's goal. And the other thing, of course, is the fact that they do have a game in hand. So how do you rate Sunderland's chances at staying up?
I think their chances are good. This is the problem sometimes when we evaluate these relegation battles, is that our focus or favouritism tends to fall with the team that's just won.
Right.
So at the minute, everyone is thinking that Newcastle are in the best position.
But it does come down to 3 points here and there. So it that kind of analysis kind of makes sense.
Well, what I would say is that Sunderland have 2 games at home. Mm. And if there's one thing I can say about the Stadium of Light, is that when needed, the Stadium of Light can fill up and be a really difficult place to play football. And again, you don't need to be pretty to score goals. I think you look at the Manchester United game at the Stadium of Light, Sunderland weren't the prettiest that day, but they got the result. And they're playing against teams that really aren't fighting for much themselves. So while I'm not suggesting either team would roll over, I would suggest that they're not likely to be as motivated for the game as their opponent, because they have nothing to play for. What's the need? If anything, you're trying to keep yourself healthy maybe for the Euros and other concerns like that. So in that regard, again, I still feel as if Sunderland are in the better position. Norwich, I think, are in the weakest position because they just haven't been able to score goals, whereas at least Sunderland, even as poor as they were at Stoke, they managed to find a goal through Jermaine Defoe. I don't think his particular penalty was a penalty. What I do think was a penalty was Jeff Cameron's handball in the first half. So, I'm sure Allardyce would say that it balances itself out a little bit. In fact, no, I tell you, he didn't. He said the exact opposite afterwards. He said that that they were unfortunate not to win the game because of the foul and the fact that there was a penalty not given. So in that regard, again, I would say that they're finding points even when they're not playing well. And those are traits that you often associate with the teams that drag themselves up and keep themselves up. I think what we'll come to find is that Sunderland's fate, when sealed, will either reinforce the idea that they are these survival specialists, or we'll look at them like we did with Wigan and say that it was just one too many. And I have a sneaking suspicion we may be finding it's closer to the former than the latter.
Chris, out of Newcastle, Sunderland, Norwich City, your picks for the teams that will go down?
I believe Norwich will go down, and I have a feeling that Newcastle will go down as well.
Oh, that's got to be hard for you to say. Karthik, your turn.
I'm going to go one more week with Norwich and Newcastle like Chris. However, I'm hedging on Newcastle v Sunderland. Again, Sunderland not getting the results that I thought they'd be getting, and they're getting points in every game, right? I think they've only lost one or two matches in the last 2 months, but for the last month and a half. But they keep getting draws, and Newcastle, they beat Villa, and they can get a point against Spurs. They might post enough on the board even with that match in hand. So I'm gonna push for one more week, but next week I might change.
And for me, it's gonna be the way it was from the start of the season, which is that Sunderland, Norwich City, and, well, Villa already relegated. So the way it stands right now is the way I see it playing out. I think Newcastle will beat Villa, and I think that result in itself will be enough to keep them in the Premier League. So let's give you an update on the other leagues. In the Championship, a 1-0 win today over QPR secured Burnley's promotion back to the Premier League. With one round of games to go, one of either Middlesbrough or Brighton will secure automatic promotion, with the other team entering the playoffs against Hull City, Derby County, and Sheffield Wednesday. Oh, and for the record, Borough and Brighton play each other next, making it a playoff game in its own right. So the game on 7th of May is going to be an exciting one. Over in Spain, a late Gareth... Go ahead, Karthik. I thought you were saying something.
Goal difference favors Borough, so Brighton has to win.
Mm, that's right. Over in Spain, a late Gareth Bale goal secured a 1-0 win over Madrid for Madrid over Real Sociedad, while 1-0 and 2-0 wins for Atletico Madrid and Barcelona, a game in which the Catalan team missed a bunch of chances, meant that the top of the table remains unchanged in La Liga. Barcelona and Atletico Madrid remain locked on 85 points each, with Barcelona having a far superior goal difference. Real Madrid are a point behind on 84, and their goal difference is actually much closer to Barcelona's. So this makes the last two games of the season incredibly thrilling, and this is going to be a must-watch TV for all of us. I think the slide of Barcelona, gentlemen, has been something to behold in the last 3 weeks. Almost Arsenal-esque, some might say. In Serie A, With Juventus having secured the title, it seems we have finally decided the Champions League teams as well. Napoli and Roma have enough of a points cushion over Inter that only something calamitous would change next season's Champions League teams. Inter will be rueing that 2-0 loss to Lazio from yesterday. And finally, in Bundesliga, a comfortable 5-1 win over Wolfsburg for Dortmund meant that they remain 5 points behind Bayern Munich, who tied 1-1 with Borussia Mönchengladbach with 4 games to go in the season. When we come back in section 3, we'll review the results from the rest of the league and preview the Champions League games. And then we'll call it a night for World Soccer Talk podcast. In the final section of tonight's podcast, we'll talk about the wins for Everton and Swansea. So let's start with the 2-1 win for Everton over Bournemouth. This is a game that didn't have a lot of impact on the league, but what was interesting was Lukaku's goal drought now continues. He has a quote-unquote drought. He has no goal in 6. Barkley remains a bit out of form, although he was involved in the build-up to the second goal. He doesn't have a goal or an assist in 10 games. Yet Everton get the win that they've wanted, that their fans have wanted. And while Bournemouth were full of industry, didn't create too much of note, Karthik. So, Karthik, anything to add about this game before I ask you what I think our listeners want to hear about, which is your thoughts on Martinez?
No, nothing much to add. I mean, Bournemouth got the points they needed when Max Gradle got back from injury, returned from injury. Afobe was a really good midseason signing, maybe the most impactful January signing this season. And then
well, other than Alexander Pato, but yeah.
Right, or Matt Miazga for our American listeners. Yeah, which is a harsh one. I'm hoping Miazga.
Yeah, I think Miazga still has a future at Chelsea. Or
get loaned out somewhere where he will actually play. But there's nothing much more to say about this. Lukaku is in a bit of a funk, which brings up the question again. In the Euros, I mentioned it earlier, Origi, prior to this injury, which is a short-term injury, which will keep him out for about 4 weeks, really looked finding form under Jurgen Klopp and doing not just scoring goals for Jurgen Klopp, but just doing all the little things that strikers don't generally do in the international game these days. So I'm not sure Lukaku even starts for Belgium this summer, believe it or not.
Yeah. So let me ask you the question that I've wanted to ask you. I love watching Everton play. I've said this many a time. And I'm always curious because I find you to normally be very measured. But when it comes to Martinez, I often hear you saying, accusing him of being a bit of a, almost a, I don't even remember what word you used, but it seemed like you were suggesting that he's kind of swindled all of the Premier League into buying into this.
Yeah, I used the term charlatan.
That's what it was.
Him. That's right. Maybe that was over the top. Yes, but I think he's a guy that's.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Do you hold him to a higher standard than you hold other managers?
It's possible. It's very possible because I see very little pushback on. Until this year, and it's come from Everton supporters. This is remarkable, guys. Normally, the media is beating the drum about how bad a manager is and how a manager needs to be replaced before the supporters of that club jump on the bandwagon. Mm-hmm. In this specific case, it was the Everton supporters who started to beat the drum. I started a while back, right? But Everton supporters after that, including our colleague Matt Jones, mm-hmm. her World Soccer Talk, who has admitted to me at times he can't even stand to watch Everton anymore. And then the media got on the bandwagon, which brings me back to the initial point, which is perhaps I do hold Martinez to a higher standard because I think the media has held him to a lower standard than they have other managers. I feel like he at Wigan he inherited a team from Steve Bruce that was not a mid-table team, but not a team that was. That should have needed to escape relegation the way they did every season. Now we transformed their playing style, and they were fun to watch, but they were struggling, and they finally did go down. Yes, he won an FA Cup there. Great run, great story. But at Everton, he inherited a team from David Moyes, spent more money than David Moyes did, got higher level players, and maybe that's a credit to him that Lukaku, Deulofeu, some of these other guys wanted to play for him. But the results just haven't been there. And the thing about Martinez that I don't like especially is that, and I've noticed this going back to his time at Wigan, The gaffer could inform us more about his time at Swansea. I have to admit, I didn't follow him that closely there. But his substitutions generally don't make sense. They generally don't work. And tactically, while he is flexible tactically in whether he sets up in this 3-5-2, which he's been fascinated with his entire management tenure in the Premier League, or a straight 4-4-2 or 4-3-3 or whatever, 4-2-3-1, he doesn't tend to be terribly flexible in-game with his formations. So I just don't think he's a very good manager. I think he might be fine for a club like Norwich. He was fine for Wigan. I just think Everton is a bigger club than that, and they're going to, now they've got some investment, they're going to get a better manager than him. Rafa Benitez would have been the guy. He's off the market now, even though I know a former Liverpool man shouldn't manage Everton. He lives there, and I think it would have worked, but they waited too long, so they're not going to get him.
But don't you think that he's... First of all, the style of football that Everton plays is a throwback to the kind of football that I think a lot of people like watching. I know that it's frustrating for Everton supporters that they drop points like the way they did against Chelsea at the end, against Bournemouth at the end. But it's a very attacking kind of football that can be fixed defensively to make improvements. And let's not forget that the two seasons he's been in charge at Everton, he's had league positions that have not been too dissimilar from how they were under Moyes. Under Moyes, they were as high as fifth, and they've been as low as 11th under Moyes. So it's not unprecedented.
Toward the end of Moyes' tenure, they never finished 11th. I mean, people who have come back at me with this argument have said, well, Moyes finished 14th 1 year or something like that, but it was very early in his tenure, mm-hmm. and he inherited... Moyes inherited an Everton side. Moyes inherited an Everton side that was lucky they were still in the Premier League. They were so close to relegation on several occasions, mm-hmm. and he gradually built them up from a team fighting relegation every season to a team knocking on the door of Europe every year at a time when there was a huge discrepancy in spending between the top clubs and clubs like Everton, which there won't be anymore because of this television deal. So Martinez inherited that Everton, and he's made that Everton worse. He's been surpassed by the likes of West Ham and Southampton and Leicester, obviously. Look, Everton was in the same conversation as Spurs when Moyes left. They were at the same point as Spurs. Where are those two clubs now?
Right. Not very similar. Great points, and we'll talk about this more another time. When I have better points to make. I guess I didn't prepare myself for this battle. Chris, let's move to across Merseyside. Let's talk about
the inner monologue of Ted Cruz for a second there.
Yeah, let's talk about Leicester. Let's talk about Liverpool losing to Swans, to Gaffer's beloved Swans, 3-1. Heavily rotated Liverpool side, and everyone I've spoken to who is a Liverpool supporter, there's a sense of, well, let's just focus on Thursday. But you cannot get away from some of the things that Liverpool keeps showing. I know this was a heavily rotated side, but set-piece defending, yet again, continues to be a joke for Liverpool. Probably will come into play against Villarreal. And what I want to point out is Liverpool, we talk about Liverpool Jekyll and Hyde syndrome. I think it's mostly in defense, because you have these brilliant performances like they had in the first leg against Borussia Dortmund, which I thought was one of the best defensive performances in a while. And then you also have awful performance in this, where for the third goal, they look like a bunch of 10-year-olds.
I think that's a very good way to put it, Nipun. I think what I would say as well is that you have to accept that Jurgen Klopp has come in mid-season and is trying to teach a lot of players, arguably a lot of new ideas. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a maturation process in there. There's going to be a period of difficulty as well, where some of them don't understand what they're being asked to do, or don't always get it right. Because again, you can understand how to do something and still not get it right when you're learning something for the first time. I think the difficulty for Liverpool is that because the Villarreal game is firmly in their mind, if they don't achieve something with that, it will feel like a failure. When actually, if you were to take them back to the 8th of October and say, okay, by the end of the season, you could be on the cusp of a Europa League final and doing relatively okay in the league, would you take that? They'd probably say, yeah,
right.
Because it's not a terrible sense of achievement relative to where they were now. The fact that they've got this, you could arguably draw comparisons to Arsenal in that sense and say the fact that they are where they are now, the expectation has consequently risen because they've seen these little flittering and flickering moments with Jurgen Klopp of a team that could challenge for a Premier League title. They've been able to dismantle Man City, for example. it's just getting that consistency again. The difference is that Jurgen Klopp has just dropped in there, so there's going to be more time afforded to him, and rightly so. I think I'm more curious with Liverpool now to see what they do in the summer. I almost think it's very pointless kind of watching them from now until the end of the season, because essentially what you're seeing is live training drills against real opponents. Come the summer, though, when he has the opportunity to potentially go and get someone like Marc-Andre ter Stegen in goal and other people who, again, are more in his way of thinking, then come the start of next season, you'll be able to gauge kind of where the real problems are. Because if he signs some defenders that are able to understand his process a little bit better, then that problem may eradicate itself. It could also be a situation that Rafa Benitez found himself in, where he used zonal marking, I believe, quite consistently, and was quite consistently criticised for it because it was often how they would concede from set pieces. Now, I'm not looking to spark the debate between man marking and zonal marking. That's for another time. But whether it's an actual problem, I think you'll know more come the start of next season, because then he'll have had an opportunity to essentially work his way through those problems and arguably shift some players who he already thinks aren't part of the future of the football club.
Karthik, let's transition into previewing the games for the Champions League games tomorrow and Wednesday. Let's start with you with the Bayern Atletico Madrid game. The game is poised with a one goal difference, Atletico Madrid having won 1-0. I think with a scoreline like that, you have to give the advantage to Atletico Madrid. But Bayern have an incredible record at home. Interestingly, Atletico Madrid have a great record against German sides. So something's going to give in this game. Last week, I thought Vidal was probably the only good player for Bayern. Atletico Madrid would possibly be missing Thiago, possibly Carrasco and Godin. So your thoughts on this game?
Yeah, I think it's really going to depend on those injuries. If Godin is missing in particular, Carrasco also for that matter, I think the tide might tilt in Bayern's favor. Otherwise, I think Atleti see this out. They probably get a 0-0 or 1-1 and get out of there and go to the final.
Especially
and
with
I think
their
they're the favorite
defensive
in
record,
this competition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think they're the favorite in this competition and would expect them to win the Champions League this year. They were so close 2 seasons ago. But Godin injury in particular could completely change that.
Yeah, it'll be Pep's last chance to win the Champions League with Bayern. I think that's the one dark mark against his time in Germany, having gone out at the semifinal stage. I think it was the semifinal stage both years that he's been at Bayern. Am I correct in that? It was Barcelona and...
Yeah, and he could... And complete the trifecta of the three big Spanish clubs, right, knocking them out in 3 years. So that would be unfortunate. And they still, by the way, have not clinched the league title. 2 matches to go.
Right.
Dortmund technically can catch them if they lose both their games and Dortmund wins both theirs. Unlikely to happen. But they've taken their eye off the ball a little bit in the league also. And mm-hmm. what people expected to be a 20-point – people expected Bayern to run away with the Bundesliga the way PSG did in France this year. Right. That hasn't happened.
Absolutely. And Bayern, by the way, will also be missing Robin and possibly Ribery, which might complicate things against the best defense in Europe. Chris, talk about Madrid City poised 0-0. Usually we go to Karthik with City questions, but we already covered City with him. So let me ask you, last time Real Madrid played City at Bernabeu, they snatched a 3-2 win with 2 late goals. To this game, they'll be missing Arbeloa and Benzema, possibly Ronaldo, although he has trained. So your thoughts on this game?
I find City one of the hardest teams to predict at present, because the potential to flip between brilliant and really poor seems quite consistent, which I guess there's an irony nestled in there somewhere. The performance at the weekend was incredibly poor, and I think, again, we've discussed, as we often do, the changes that will have to occur when Pep Guardiola comes in and how many of the current crop actually are able to fit with his ideas. I guess it's a lead on slightly from Jurgen Klopp in that sense. I struggle to see many who will. I think the likes of Navas, I think Otamendi, Mangala, they're going to have to do a lot of changing. Mangala's perhaps one that could follow a similar trajectory to Jerome Boateng in that sense and gain some intelligence with his play. But for the present, I feel as if they're just not good enough to stop that Real Madrid front line. I think there's too much quality in there, away from home particularly, where they have struggled for them to stop that. I think they did very well in getting that result at the Etihad last time out. But I can't see a repeat of that, and I certainly can't see a narrow 1-0 or 1-1 result just because of how poor they are. And equally, I'm not convinced that he will start Iheanacho. I think if I could look at the starting 11s, then I might be able to say, okay, there's a potential for them here. But the fact that he continues to put Iheanacho on the bench when he's not only the most informed striker they've got, I think he's arguably the best at this precise moment in terms of what he gives them, both alongside Aguero, but also with the team in general. That to me is still quite baffling, and I'm curious as to why he sees the need to keep putting him on the bench and give others a chance.
That's the million-pound question for Manchester City supporters, and it's been a recurring question since October or November when Iheanacho was clearly coming off the bench, influencing matches. Even if he wasn't scoring goals, he was influencing matches in a way that no other player, these guys had spent millions and millions of quid on, were doing. And I don't know, Chris. That is the question that is bugging every Manchester City supporter, and the assumption is Iheanacho will not start, and that the team will be behind late in this match, and he'll be thrown out in the 70th or 75th minute. That's just what we're thinking.
Chris and I will be back on Wednesday to discuss how this played out. We will have the starting lineups and the final scores for you for both those games by then, and we'll preview what will be an exciting Premier League weekend. Until then, on behalf of World Soccer Talk, Chris Henage and myself, Karthik.
Enjoy your football.